each group is going to talk about what they were talking about to the wider group, and then we're going to broaden it out, gently interrogate it, question it. So that each session will be about 10 minutes. Okay. And I also think that the one that I cut out was safety. I'm going to quickly talk about that. I'll do that one. But I had it as personal as political goes first. But
okay.
You don't have. Are you happy with that?
Yeah, fine. You go first. Okay, yeah. I can talk about this. Well, I say yours, and you say my. Okay.
No,
okay.
I'm happy for you to share right. Your.
Okay,
yeah.
So we. I'm just going to go into
yeah.
It.
Yeah,
okay.
And I'm going to time it to 10
okay.
Minutes.
So
I mean, not you guys talking.
No.
The
okay, so I'm just going to throw some things out there. So we're talking about stories needing to be told, okay? And the idea of how do you share those? Where does the line go between sharing them and exposing them in a negative way? This is what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
It's sharing in the positive. So the urgency for stories to be told and being drawn as a female to female stories in the ways of shedding light and bringing them into light. So that's one aspect. Talking about the personal is political, and the idea of something being a given. So, for example, I would use my hair in my work. I would use knitting needles. I would use certain colours or female belts, and how that then, without, it was an intuitive choice, but a very considered choice as well. And how then that's a given, and other people. Introducing, you know, feminism to that, to the personal, you know. So the idea also personal in brackets private, and then political in brackets public, and how those kind of go into one another, you know. And then to go back to Caroline's comment about timing. How to silently be political about something that is very personal and a given and very urgent.
And by given, you were kind of, you know, we kind of teased that out as kind of being like that it's inherent in your work.
Yes.
As I was saying, one of the things that struck me about your work, if you don't mind me saying, was just, you know, she said yesterday about the braid, right, the braid in the face, and she said it's such a familiar image, people are familiar with that. So the thing that struck me about it is it's actually women are familiar with that, but men aren't, you know, and so for me, the feminism. Well, like the way that I think it is and should be is inherent in her work, and the anxiety was when people applied that label to it.
Mm.
Because I picked up that you were feeling some sort of obligation with that sort of burden.
Well, yes, because you know it's your work, it's personal,
yeah.
But you're making it public, and then someone introduces this thing, which is not alien, because I know about feminism, but I've never connected it to the practice. But then also not wanting to reject it, because I have a sense that it is a given, so I can't reject it. I won't reject it, but also, it's not something that I would, you know, loudly talk about. But not because I don't feel like it belongs, but I think that it has something to do. It's an inherent thing that I don't feel like I want to expose, but will share if I need to.
I think that's really interesting in terms of like how the critic works in an artwork and like where they. And you mentioned it earlier when the blurb about comes in, and so I'm really interested in like a different critical position that doesn't sort of like come in from the outside and then say talk about the work, but instead like we have a conversation, and so that there is some kind of sharing involved, so that if then something comes up that it's been a conversation between the artist and the writer. So that, like, I think when you said that word sharing, and then that is the line to what's inherent and then what is gifted to somebody and shared about the practice, that would maybe ease that tension between, you knowing that the feminism is inherent, but suddenly it's,
Because actually when somebody reviewed my play, they sent a female journalist who is known for kind of like she'd be the one who talks about feminist issues, and that annoyed me because it's like, why couldn't it be any theatre critic? Do you know what I mean? Like, I wanted to know what any of them would have thought of the show. The fact that she was their token person for this issue pissed me off, you know?
It's somebody sort of dominating what you've done, where there's a place of power.
And reducing it.
There's a change. And I think if I'm saying I'm a feminist critic, then I think that I have to be aware of that power dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's really important that that's a thing that's shared, and that's like a conversation with the work.
Yeah.
There's a judgment about the work.
There's
an interview that Patrick Fox did with Anthony Rivera of some work he had done in Brighton, and the interview is tender. It's just gorgeous. You know, you see it online. But I'm really getting what you're saying there about the not dominating your consuming the work from your own perspective, but really kind of teasing it out with the creator. Which you could, that definitely was his approach. It was really a sort of tender exchange.
What did you say about that? It was a conversation about the work rather than what's the impact?
Yeah, I think it's this a conversation with the work rather than like a judgment.
That's it, rather than a judgment. Yeah,
or rather than a judgment.
Because then, you know, then you've got a sort of layering and then which is
it does a disservice.
Because, and I think the word sharing is really important because then it's whether it's shared or whether it's taken out of your hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's an issue with language as well, that language can be like a shared thing, and it is, and that's the brilliant thing, that you can't keep control over what a word means, but it's a collective like production, but then that it's also quite remarkable.
And that's a very generous way of doing it, because then, you know, then people don't have this default dismissive, you know, feeling about, well, in this case, you know, feminism.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Or
I'm just wondering, say for example, the two examples you just gave to me, writing question forward vision of his work, and that was described from as a critic. You know, like no longer fair view. To review your work as to go from folks' perspective. I'm just wondering if those people have, or if a way to look at it might be that these people have the understanding to make these readings into the work, because like there's a huge gap in education in terms of cultural studies of what, like, of feminist thought. In general, but maybe that person is invited, or maybe that person picks it up because they just are familiar with, or interpret things using that analysis. So kind of books that are said about expertise in a way. But I'm just wondering if the problem might be, well, for me, so I'm always thinking about it sort of differently. I'm wondering if the problem might be when feminism is used as a label. Artists, we typically reject labels because it boxes things in, like stops the work, like speaking. But it's used as a label as opposed to as a description, as one of the number of descriptions.
Yeah.
And again, feminism tends to be like a big, big label rather than in the way it's talked about, or in what it now means, that meaning. But I guess
this
is kind of the question
why. Can I just bring it back to the personal as political part of it? Just bring it back to that. This is important, and this will come through the whole day, I think, these questions, these other questions. But what I think is quite interesting is this, more than anything, it's the from the 70s, so second wave feminism, through to today, it's the most salient truth, I think, that still exists. Lots of aspects of 70s feminism have moved away or beyond or whatever because we're somewhere else. But I think it seems to me very much the case that the personal is political is a feminist starting point is very clear because it came out in all of your work, all of our work, because we, all of us, either were doing stuff with our bodies, you know, starting with ourselves, stuff with woman-based crafts or things that are understood as gendered crafts, that's a personal thing, a personal craft, or in the case of the field, and how we organise power and decision making. This is not how art used to be made, particularly since feminism. Lots of other people do art this way, but very much understanding that what we do in our bodies, how we operate, is always political. There was a division up until feminism where politics was something out there, and then you went home and beat your wife, politics being a certain kind of socialist politics, and then you went home and beat your wife, and that was okay because politics didn't start at home. I think that there's the legacy of 70s feminism is understanding who does the dishes is a feminist issue. You know, at home, how we are at all times is feminism, or at least to be discussed in these terms, whether or not the gender division, for whatever reasons, continues at home or whatever. But this is where it begins, and that there is no politics out there without it being in here as well, and how we operate.
Talk more about that.
I was going to say that I think it's still, and it's become, it has this powerful slogan, personal is political, but I think it's still a massively important contribution that feminism brings to social left-wing politics or socialism that hasn't really yet, that needs to be acknowledged more or used in socialist practice, because I have this, I'm part of a feminist reading group, I go back to Glasgow to do it actually, that's about, it's quite an extreme group, it's about bludgeoned female subjectivity, and the organisers of the group, one of the organisers, Emma Balkan, is writing about commons, that's her PhD topic, so
commons.
About the commons. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like common ownership, and I spoke to her about how the book group fits into her PhD, and she said, actually, I feel that the book group is like some kind of subconscious bit to the PhD, that I can't get in the PhD somehow, because, you know, on the left, like, this idea of subjectivity and the individual and the personal journey are so taboo, because it has to be, you know, if you're talking about commons, it has to be we, it has to be, you know. And somehow, like, it means that all these individual things, like concerns of the individual, get shut out of the left wing. And I think that's really problematic, because then individualism gets completely taken over by the right and anything consumeristic, and that becomes the only way to. And I think that that's a real loss, because we are individuals and we have our personal journeys. And to me, that's where feminism needs to have a louder voice. On the left, a much louder voice, because that it's reframing individualism. Because it shouldn't. I think it's too much to give it up. The whole thing of individualism, just to consumerism and to neoliberalism and to right-wing politics. I think it means that the movement's not complete. So I think it's massively important, and that still she's writing on commons at that level, and the book group is, which is a group of people. And it's supposed to be like, in a way, it's a commons project, because we decide the books between us and them, and there that it cannot be integrated into this chat about commons. So it's like a lot of, I think that's where there's a lot of work to do somehow.
So where does that come into? How does feminism then play into personal journeys, or for example, people who, because of migration, then, you know, does that have any links at all? Because there's people who, for example, moved from this country to this country, you know, like you've got this kind of multifaceted cultural background, you don't really belong.
Mm-hmm.
So how does, you know, if feminism talks about the individual or brings it back to the individual or the personal, what kind of, is there any parallels there? That might,
I feel like what you just described is a, is intersectionality, which, and from my understanding of it, kind of answers your question, that the, like, looking at individuals, really understanding people's subjectivity from all of their experiences, and like the real, like the uniqueness, but the context that's created their experience, and so intersectionality, like life is probably is more obvious than when it comes to issues of color, race. and it's the hotbed of debate within left politics right now as well. It is this kind of real tension zone between feminism and socialism, anarchism, because those strands have not maybe been open to recognizing that as much as feminism is asking, but because it leaves, if they're asking it precisely, I feel, because it leaves out what you just asked.
Okay, we've gone. I can see this is going to be terrible because we're 50% over. So that's okay. I'm going to now ask for hospitality. We're going to explore hospitality for 10 plus minutes.
I think it sort of crosses over a lot with the last question as well. But we talked about, Olga mentioned it being a matter of borders, in negotiating, sort of every time you come into a situation where your borders are of intimacy, really. And I thought that was really interesting because this conception of hospitality as a place that, be trying to negotiate a territory, but I see it very much like the word hospitality comes with the idea of a where is it, and it's a place that two parties, the guests and the host, are negotiating. So we talked about that, and then the risks involved with the guests and the worries of being the host, and trying to figure out which one you would prefer if you had to pick whether you were to be the guest or the host, kind of weighing up the difficulties.
I have this impression that there is also, a situation of power involved, definitely a host is more powerful because the person might just not draw these borders of intimacy and engagement. Guests seems to be more vulnerable, but then if guests is too active, maybe cross the line, then it's kind of violence also. So it's
and I think you said something really nice as well, because part of it was talking about all the difficulties, and but then you said you talked about an experience of knowing in advance that you're invited to someone, and then when the moment comes, you don't feel like it so much. Oh, she said, but then you have to because it's already planned, and then you open the door and you see their face, and everything changes. And I thought that was really lovely, somehow description of something between two people that can't be decided in advance or something.
And then you see these people, and you know that you can't somehow, fail them. You take this role, it's given. And for example, for me, it's just, I even don't feel that I have to decide, but just, it's a change in me. Once I'm opening the door, okay, nice to see you. And I really feel it's nice, but...
But there's a lot of expectations, as guests or hosting, and the cultural sort of expectations that I would find it offensive actually sometimes as a guest. I have to question myself on this, or put myself up. If something isn't as I expected it to be, if there is
such as
yesterday, even arriving and nobody was here, I just am I in the wrong place? Check my email, thought, actually, that was why I came late today. Because loads of stuff was going on last night, and I decided to stay an hour away from here and just travel again. But part of it definitely was I'm not going to burst myself because maybe we're not going to start on time. So, anyway, that was one thing. But just arriving to something, and for there to be something like colour and a drink, For me, it's I went to Barcelona for a training thing, and people came from all over Europe, and there was no water, there was no
was just like, what? I was so offended, you know. I was like, what the hell?
Mm.
You know, and there's supposed to be an introductory kind of period, a half hour before we begin. It didn't happen, you know. There was no introductions, there was no hospitality.
Yeah.
It's a really bad start to making the most of what we could offer each other. You know, it's just like, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, I had a conversation with a friend, she's going to get married, and she was trying to talk, she started off by saying that her and her boyfriend, they hate weddings, like they hate them, you know? Like, and like, I understand exactly what she means, like, you know, like, I've been to someone, you know, like, sometimes they're over formal, and they're just so prescribed, and blah, blah, blah. And so she was trying to tease out what they wanted and what they didn't want and everything. And I was like, yeah, but you know, Maeve, you know, people get really anxious if they don't know how to behave. Like, there's a certain reassurance. It's like when you're organizing events, there's a reassurance in knowing what they're going to be doing, even though it doesn't actually ask anything of them. Because, like, you know those people who are like, well, what do we do now? I mean, like,
yeah.
You know, or like,
maybe
well, like,
those people.
Yeah, oh, no, but I mean, you know, like, what I'm saying to her is that regardless of what she did, she would need somebody, be it a friend or whatever, to take on the role of being the host almost, who would be like, okay, now we're going to go, what's going to happen today is this, this, and this. Because people they get very anxious if they don't know how they're supposed to behave, particularly when it's a social occasion, because they feel like they're being looked at or something, do you know what I mean? Or
so
you know,
you have a kind of responsibility here,
yeah,
involved as well.
Because
yeah,
there's a reassurance in knowing what to do. You know, like if you're going to a dinner party, you know you're going to eat, you know you might bring the wine, you know what I mean? But if you arrive and it's like, oh no, you have to cook your own food in the middle of the room, you know what I mean? There's
exactly
an anxiety around it,
yeah.
It's a big social thing,
mm-hmm.
you know. Which isn't a bad thing, it's just kind of funny, you know. Like, you do need somebody to host it and put people at ease.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about the feminist angle of this.
Yeah.
Women as hosts and containers.
Well, the thing that I thought of instantly was the hospitality industry, which I, in my experience from like the first job and everything, is the most sexist environment I've ever worked in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, particularly kitchens and stuff like that. And I've talked to friends, because we all waitressed over the years, and it was all a very sexualized environment, and kind of given that like the chefs, all men, and the head waitress and stuff like that could treat me very kind of,
oh God,
sexually,
yes.
You know?
It's like universal law.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's
undervalued. Yeah, I would say that it's a really important thing, like hospitality, and it's not valued. So
no.
Yeah, I would say it's a hidden labor or something, like an unacknowledged labor, and yeah, so it's like at the bottom, and then you get bad treatment. So it's not.
The women in my family are like experts. Really, really expert in hospitality, and it's actually it's something we all really acknowledge, but it's just within our family, really. But it's an area I've never worked in, and I've never wished to work in, to be honest, especially my food. I could do, you know, other bits of it, but I could never match up to the aunts and the mother, and in terms of hospitality.
So in feminist terms, how does that
yeah.
feel? Is that pressure for you? Is that a negative role model or a positive role model?
In one way, it's maybe overgiving, you know, in that they don't enjoy the party, you know,
yeah.
so much. But they do get a lot. I mean, they love that bit that they
yeah.
do. I mean,
but
there was a
why do you think they do that?
Why do they do it?
Why do you think they love it? They don't enjoy it.
Well, there's a choice that they make. There's, you know,
there's a certain amount of power in it.
Well, there's power, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they create an atmosphere that allows for, you know, lots of fun to happen. And
but not for them.
Good experience.
For other people.
I think that they do get a lot of pleasure out of it.
For them, it's this responsibility again, and that's why
they're
expectations and so on, so they're the culprits if anything happens. But then, you know, there are nice things if you love to cook and,
mm-hmm.
yeah, these kind of things you said, that they can be creative somehow, you know, they're authors of an event, you know, somehow. But then they cannot really maybe navigate how to use this event, you know, so they create something and then other are taking it over. Maybe something like that, I'd say.
Sounds like giving without actually giving.
Yeah, for myself, I know that if there, you know, people are coming over, like we would do a little sort of like you do this, I do that type of situation. So it's not waiting for me to offer the tea or something like this, you know. But I'm much more aware of it from just the family experience that the women, especially, they're just so good at it.
Mm-hmm.
But
why can I please?
I can invite anybody over there really, but yeah, there's a sacrificial element to it.
I think there's an interesting tension around the role of mother as nurturer and absolute. You know, I've heard lots of I've read things around breastfeeding that's very sensual and love can be. I know it can be fucking awful, but. Can be essential and pleasurable to the woman, but the idea of being depleted and take, you know, a woman having to eat so much in order for it to come out of her breast to feed this child, like that kind of. So there's an interesting tension around these roles where of giving and sucker and who is nurtured and who's depleted. And just, I don't think there's a simple answer. It's like not a don't and a do, but an awareness and mindfulness of all the various tensions involved in giving and nurturing others and self.
I was saying about, is it okay if I come in again?
It is, and then you can straight away go on to yours.
I was telling Alana about a woman I work with who's a creative writing facilitator, and she sets up a picnic trolley, we'll say, in an institution, an acute mental health setting. And when I saw her doing this, I was like, oh my God, such a political, such an act in that setting, because she was just like, everybody has to drink out of disposable cups, and it's stainless steel, and it's all for kind of hygiene and management sort of, you know, around consumption of food, and nothing about the pleasure of sharing, and so that's what she does. But I want to honour her, maybe, or just there's a commission maybe that I hope to go for to create a tea trolley kind of based on her approach, really. So she starts off with that's choice, but there's a richness to it, you know. That's just, it's really like you're just like, oh, this is really different, especially in that session. A care, but yeah, it's not just about the greeting and the warmth and that, you know. It's quite it kind of undermines or it asks the setting, you know, the institution to think about how it relates to people who use that service.
Yeah,
sorry, I had to go the long way around saying that.
Great. So. Expertise, the status, expertise and status.
We talked a lot about, most of our time was actually talking about how we introduce ourselves. Because in an introduction with any group individual, we bring our, I was talking about how we bring the baggage of. Or what is perceived as an elitist status as an artist, in terms of that's the expertise that we can claim. And do you have a say that I don't know where I'm going to do that? I guess I was saying how I have worked collaboratively with male artists that have no qualms whatsoever about introducing themselves as art experts. They do, and it's just incredible to see the dynamic group that evolves after that. And I and other female collaborators that I work with are a lot more reticent. So there's an interesting gender reticent or hesitant to introduce themselves in that way. And so there's a very interesting, there's a huge gender disparity in that has to do with how, you know, our gender and culture, I think. I am conscious of the inequality that I might highlight within the group because I have middle class background, I went to art college, and I don't have to worry about, you know, I have this luxury of picking and
choosing this artist. I'm certainly a photographer, I'm feeling popular like most of their artists, but I knew I was going to fall back on this with regard to my class. And that makes me not talk about my expertise so much. Whereas with some male artists, they have no grants, none of those grants whatsoever. And I guess what Niamh highlighted was that like just coming forward and claiming your place as the expert, the experienced one in your practice, maybe creates a dynamic then where both can have the confidence to recognize who they are and bring and kind of, you were talking about finding out more than about what each other can do based from that jump. So we talked about that, but I had some more extra questions.
Well, the reason why I put this one in was actually from a back email that we had, because Siobhan said that she didn't want to be introduced today as an expert, and I totally got the reason why, because it can set up a hierarchy, an unnecessary hierarchy for everybody else. So, you know, in other words, if there's an expert, then what the hell are the rest of us? So I get why that's a negative thing. But what you just said about how men very easily claim their expertise, I think we have to be conscious that we don't. And what we lose in the name of enacting an anti-hierarchical dynamic, what we're trying to do in creating a non-hierarchical dynamic might be to give away too much and to disempower ourselves for the sake of others. And for me, this is not a good feminist practice.
So what would we do
instead?
Yeah.
For me, I would look for the expertise of everyone. Because I'm not going to pretend to you guys that I don't have a PhD, that I haven't spent my entire life and many, many, many years thinking about a certain aspect. I'm not going to pretend I'm an expert on everything, but I'm going to tell you I am absolutely. My PhD has given me the right to say I'm an expert, and I'm so going to claim that, because that was hard earned, you know. But this is not to disavow anybody else's expertise in their own field. What annoys me more than anything is when men claim expertise over things that they're not, you know, when they claim to understand things that they don't. And men will do this more often than not because they are
mansplaining.
They will claim expertise. So it's about, for me, in these engagements, it's about finding the expertise that we all have, but not disavowing my expertise by any stretch of the imagination. Because for me, I have seen women give way power too often.
I remember
it picks up at the end of my presentation yesterday, and where I'm at with my work, because I'd like to start from different positions.
I remember when my first short story got published, my uncle, who I would have known was quite an arrogant man, you know, and not particularly close to him or whatever, but never forget, he walked into the kitchen of the house when I was home and he shook my hand. But even the way he was doing that, it was like he was
bestowing.
Yes. And do you know what he said? He said, I've ever since I've been trying to remember the exact wording of it, but he said, I couldn't have written it. He said, I couldn't have written it better myself or something like that.
Oh.
And then also there's a man of the road, again, who I knew, he's really like away with the fairies in terms of his, he just thinks he's an expert on anything, you know, like, and my parents even would kind of mock him for it. It's like, oh sure, once you say something to him, he'll be like, oh yeah, sure, I know them really well, kind of thing, right? So when I, again, a short story, he's like, I'd often be walking down the road now and I'd be thinking to myself, oh, you know, I should write a story about that. Like, you know, just completely saying that they could do what I did, they choose not to, you know? And so how nice it was of me that I had the opportunity to do it, because if I wasn't doing it, they would. You know, it was so weird.
Yeah.
So weird.
It's a nice thing about your originality as well.
Yeah.
Like, which is so important, like, I suppose, to a certain, like, artistic narrative.
It's
so sorry,
I also maybe this kind of experience, you know, that you know which you've mentioned, you know, like, and it's just, you know, it makes you mad, you know, because it's so unjust and not true.
Small things. You have to break down to think about the people ticking off things on the job, on the job description, and that men only have to have like two out of the whole job description. They'll think, oh yeah, I'll go for this. Whereas women have to tick off all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, before they go for it. And I don't know, kind of like the study now. But there's something I like about the way men would sort of adventure into something like chancy, sort of, you know,
yeah.
Like chance in their arm. I I love about that as well, you know.
Well, there's a confidence to it, this kind of envy, you know.
Yeah.
The competition to take risks in society, whereas, like, from very, very young, you're told to be safe, they're told to support the hero.
Yeah.
The questions that were kind of running to my mind since I was talking, and definitely to pick up on, you know, her line thing was coming in about a fat town conversation. Maybe should bring my personal to the political conversation. The reason I would say resident to describe as expert is because of the things I've been thinking about in feminism. And one of them is the importance of recognizing subjective knowledge, and that in our subjectivity we are all our experts. So who can claim to then be expert, and trying to honor that? Yeah, but trying to honor that in a way that doesn't it's a constant tension for me. And then the other thing is that, I am very, very new to understanding or even really exploring feminism as feminism in a sense. You know, within the last few years, I would say. So I was literally anxious about how I might be presented to a group of my people. I've already been working on this for the last several decades, whatever. But I kind of realized that that my anxiety about that plays into these often academic standards and conversations around feminism, what it is and what it isn't. And the academy, we understand, is a very patriarchal institution. So that is the thing that I'm up against in my imagination when I get into these conversations. And even when, I think Sinead, you mentioned these like online conversations, because that's the other space that I find very difficult to try and like articulate my ideas around feminism. Working online and the social media is people are describing it as the fourth wave of feminism. The question about it, but it's I think without forgetting that actually the architecture of the cyber world is also patriarchal, and it's based on patriarchal systems of exchange of information and knowledge, and even the way the interfaces, the way they're designed, have people would argue that are interested programming have patriarchal values, so intrinsic to the way that they're created, and so representative of our culture that we don't see the distinction between those. I suppose, so I guess that's the thing I think I'm worried about, the spheres I come into in terms of when I come in with, I guess, being or anyone who's going to be described as like expert.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's my personal anxiety is pushing what I can see around it for all of us.
Mm-hmm. And I think I sort of fed into it a little bit because you came up with that in the email that we had spoken as well. And I'm trying to articulate. I think I like to define myself in relation to people. So I actually find it very difficult. And I know the value in you when you go around at the start and you introduce yourself. But I almost find it's like when you learn people's... I think it would be better to learn people's names when you've had a long chat with them, because then you can associate it with something. And so I think my difficulty is that I can't possibly say if I'm an expert until I know what... You know, I'd like to have a relational definition. And often, like... So we talked about the fact that, yeah, I've got this kind of art historical background, but also practice as an artist, like on the margins, and like not in the art world. So it seems to be there's whole other hierarchy about being an artist in the art world, being a community artist, or in the education department in a gallery, which is what I've done. So I've done community arts. And so I think immediately I was like, well, I'm just learning in terms of being an artist, you know, which is like some of the conversation we had about my reticence about that. And like I'd find myself in relation. So I'm collaborating with artists, and one artist, Helen Smith, who's also doing a PhD. We had long chats, and eventually she wanted to define what I was. Like, she was quite fun. She was like, you're a critical theorist, Caroline. That's what you are. And then I think that comes back to, like, people feeling comfortable with each other as well, that they do want, like, you don't want to be in a box and you have intersectional knowledge and stuff, but then also the other person wants to be able to locate you. So then I think then the expertise is important. But yeah, I found that in every collaboration it's been a little bit different. So I've worked with other artists who want me to be, you know, who said, well, this is your concept, and, you know, they push me to do the creative things. So they have a different role for me, and I'm happy as well. But I think it's about finding yourself in relation to people, which you don't get if you're like, if you come in and you've got this is what I am and I'm an expert, because you haven't heard everybody else. Like, I just don't, I think it's a narrow way to have self-definition, because it is in a vacuum, basically, mm-hmm. in some ways. And,
Before I moved to safety, because I heard you say, what did you say about originality?
Yes,
yeah,
so I missed what you said.
Oh, yeah.
There.
I just said that it's kind of like this sort of artistic, this long artistic tradition of originality, and that if he says to me, well, I've often thought, basically, you know, I'm making assumptions about him, but I'm saying that he's in this narrative of, well, the artist comes up with the original thought, so if he's taking your status as an artist away by that, it's all because he's taking, he's questioning its originality.
It's like God love
God love him.
But you know, I question originality anyway.
Okay, and the final part is safety, which is just what I'm finding interesting is that we're just talking about things from different angles, but it's all really the same thing, just opening up different aspects of the discussion. Because in a way, safety already came out of what you just said about risk and safety. That girls are nurtured to sit on mum's lap, to be risk averse, to not go climbing and making their dresses muddy and all that kind of stuff. And boys are, and there's lots and lots of feminist studies, not feminist, but studies, which happen to prove a feminist point, that boys are from the knee onwards, encouraged differently from girls. That girls are here for cuddles, and boys are there for action.
Even before.
Absolutely. And that, well, this goes to the nature-nurture debate and how much is, you know, genetic and how much isn't. And it's up to you where you fall on that one. But there's definitely nurture involved in being risk-averse, in us being gendered as women to be less risky, risk-taking. And also us less occupying of space, occupying of resources. You know, many of us, even if my parents claim that they treated us all equally. I have one brother and one sister, so two girls and a boy, my brother's in the middle. Without a doubt, my brother was given more food than us in this day and age, or in that day and age. It's already a long time ago now. A bit of lava. And when I think about it, what my parents talk about, I would be shocked. They would be shocked for me to reflect this at them. But he's a growing boy. He does more activity. There's reasons for him getting more food than me. You know. Anyway, just to put it like that. But so there's a question around risk and safety and what we choose to do and whether we choose the safe option because we've been gendered to do things safely rather than risk more. Whether we not allow each other to take the risky option as well, like, you know, how we can create networks that allow and afford each other to take the risky option, given given that it's not our role, it's somebody else's role to do the risky thing. So that's a question. None of this was what I was actually thinking about when I was thinking about safety. When I thought about safety and then having that as a topic, I was thinking about, for me, emotional safety, the emotional safety of a group is incredibly important. There's this thing, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I don't know if you've worked in education, this might be familiar to you. You know that you have to have a full belly, you have to have, and you have to be somewhere safe, physically safe, that you're not being bombed in order to learn. Like, there are certain things that you need in order to learn. For me, yes, in order to learn, but in order to create, in order to be artists, to go somewhere else. And in the safety that he describes, I'm pretty sure he does not describe emotional safety, but for me it's a feminist thing to highlight emotional safety, which is, and what we did this morning around whether that other person was going to join us was, for me, predicated on my understanding of what emotional safety is. We as a group and as individuals have needs, emotional needs, which we need to foreground, because it is from that point that we will make work, that we will be as creative and risk-taking as we can only be risky from a place of safety. So for me, I am very, very foregrounding emotional safety. And for me, that's a feminist action, as much as hospitality is a feminist action, that to foreground hospitality without being too much nurturing is a feminist practice. That's my understanding of feminism. Because for me, feminism is about equality and creating. And in creating, we cannot have equality without there being safety first. That's opening up now. I think that what happens in, unless safety is paramounted, is put as a paramount concern within a group or within an enterprise, within an art world, within a system, what happens is people default to a behaviour which is going to inevitably create inequality. So you're going to get me first, no me, elbows out. And so for me, it's not lack that creates inequality, or, you know, the elbows out, you know, only one person can get it. But it's actually a feeling of lack of safety that creates that creates a behaviour that creates inequality. That's an instinct that I feel on that one. And it is only from when we know what the rules are, because safety is us all participating to the same rules, and that there are rules, because there is, when I've worked with male anarchists who are like, no rules, I've noticed that it's men who get megaphone and take over fucking everything. These anarchists who claim that it's all about everybody being equal, dominate. Always, time and again, all the time, white men with big loud megaphones. So for me, rules create safety and therefore create equality, or create equality in people understanding how we're going to do this. They can change, you know, it can be like the game, you know, where the four-way tug of war, where they change, but we understand that they change and we do this together.
This seems to kind of underpin the idea of safe spaces.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that was established here this morning. The fact that every individual was checked. And I imagine that that even the process of discussing and checking in is kind of a foundation of trust that they build up while you're sharing and while you're explaining. And
You can disagree completely.
It's not about disagreeing. It's about, I keep hearing my older brother's voice about, you know, the strongest is definitely the person who will. He's always at me for being, you know. He's actually used the word weak, which is, I think they all know that that's probably the very inaccurate word, but because I think he's worried about his weakness when he sees my vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this idea of you need to be fierce, you need to be strong, you need to be this, that, and the other. So this idea of there can't be this collective because it's definitely, and I don't know how much of that is being a migrant, you know, and being also being the oldest without siblings to, well, after a while. So how to create that when you've got this?
For me,
parents.
Your brother is just being a classic patriarch.
Mm.
Forget the migrant, forget the anything. He for me, he is saying, he is setting up a rule, the rules of the game. He might claim it's not, he might claim it's free for all, but he's creating a set of rules in which he will win.
Yeah, yeah.
Not you.
He gets very upset when I win at poker or something. He'll be like,
but in life he's doing that, by the elbows out, by saying, you know, you've got to be strong, strong like him, not strong like you. There's strength in vulnerability.
Oh, definitely. Power
not,
and vulnerability.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And exposing it and all that. Mm-hmm. He's setting up rules in which you will lose and he will win.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he's so convincing.
Well, that's also his rules.
Because he's loving. But it's not. I'm not how loved I feel by that. Which is a difference. Mm.
Everyone's
feeling
kind of thing. In safe space, or I guess when we have a sense of a safe space, it means that we are willing to show our vulnerabilities,
mm-hmm.
and then we are maybe more open to having ourselves challenged,
mm-hmm.
perhaps changes within ourselves, and we change something outside, we change within ourselves
mm-hmm.
first. But if you come to that space with your own definitions and your definition that your way is the right way, your standards are the right standards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting that I guess there's a lot of feminist safe spaces, and you know this is a contested thing, but a lot of feminists, meaning people that identify as women and trans, will not let women as men into the space because they feel there's just too much cultural disruption of what it is they're trying to achieve in the space. Which I didn't understand for a long time, but I understand that.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you said trans as well, because I am not separatist, and everything I do is about diversity, because for me that's where the genuine safety lies. That those rules and respecting, which I'll talk about in just a minute, but you know, the Levinasian engagement with the other as other. So that's where I've come to. But I have been through separatist things. I always found that trans women who were brought up as men dominate the space anyway. So I personally, in those forums, would have preferred it to be women who were brought up as women, rather and not have anybody who was brought up as a man, because I always found that dynamic. But that said, I actually think that women can operate differently, and this is why I'm somewhere else now. I would never do separatism. I do diversity, very, very subconsciously. Because I think that the women can set up rules that make sure that the men occupy their appropriate space. I think that's possible, but women have to be...
Example?
Well, this goes back to the field that I was describing yesterday, where we demand that everybody is an adult in that space. And that can mean... And I just wanted to also say, yes, that also means women can't be little girls either.
Mm-hmm.
But in demanding that we are all adults, and that we are nobody's parent in that space, and there is no children in that space, so little boys can't act out and take up too much space, because it's a little boy thing. This is how I conceive of it. Adults can contain themselves and can contain their need to be seen, to take over. You know, you can see that in little kids, and you can go, okay, you're going to go through that phase, but when we get to the adult, we can contain ourselves, and we can listen, and we can cooperate, you know. That's an adult place to get to. So it's that demand.
Imagine you really have to talk out and describe, like, I would feel minutely, but really get a mutual understanding of what that means, because taking so unconsciously sometimes, and where it just takes so long to get through to some people that like it's actually the sexist or even like either gender. So does that take a lot of the, say when you
working groups in that way, would that take a lot of time? Or is it like I suppose it's an ongoing thing.
It's ongoing.
Yeah.
That everything about the field is an ongoing negotiation within ideals, and ideals that always fall. So it's a negotiation with reality, and the navigation of reality with values, certain values, yeah, rather than ideals, values. But sometimes it's not even verbalised because not everybody's good at that. Sometimes it's a behaviour thing. Like for instance, what happens all the time with the hospitality thing is women will make will start making tea for others,
yes,
and men will naturally fall
yes.
back and start taking it, you know. So it's about recognise, like you can start being hospitable, but as soon as you see that,
yeah, yeah.
you just don't give them a tea.
I actually did this yesterday. I made a cup of tea for an artist I'm working with. No, I didn't actually. He made his own tea because he arrived. I booked the room, and when he arrived, he was like, "Is there anywhere that I can get some tea?" And I said, "There's a canteen downstairs. Go ahead, blah blah." So he came up, and so it was just the two of us in this room on the top floor, and I was staying on afterwards because I was working on my computer. And as he's walking out the door, I noticed that he left his cup there with the tea bag in it. And like, I haven't been working with him long, so I was kind of like, "Is that?" And then I was like, "Okay, just let it go this one time." And I was like, "What the fuck does he think is going to happen to that cup?"
Yeah.
Like. He brought it up here, so why wouldn't he take it with him? And it's like, is he presuming that I will clean up after him? And whatever way I bring it back down to the kitchen, who's going to wash it? Like, he's not even... first of all, he's either not even thinking about it, or secondly, he's making a decision that it's not his responsibility, which means then that he is putting it on me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I'm not your fucking mother. Like, I was just so angry about it. And then I was like, okay, next time. You know?
No, the personal
time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I was so pissed off. I also just was really insulted by bias, you know? Because I would never ever have, like, if he was aware of it, if I drew his attention to it, he'd be mortified. But he's just not even thinking about it. It's
exactly.
Not
doing.
Yeah.
That's so typical, right? When we were talking about hospitality, the way in which women are really like grants would be more inclined to come forward is because, again, it feels like conditioning, certainly, conditioned to take care and to notice, that, like, noticing these things. But all those things that we described about hospitality, I felt, were the invisible labours of hospitality. Like, it's very hard to know when someone's noticing something.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really get rewarded for noticing, but, like, I've seen it on myself and like, other people doing it a lot. And I thought it was interesting when we were talking about this experience in grants, for example, how we were talking about this hidden labour and how we were really struggling to figure out what their reward was, because the reward is hidden as well. I presume that part of it is possibly their reward, maybe, you know, praise is something that
mm-hmm.
I enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
But that's hidden also. and like that, the whole economy is invisible, and then it's so hard to challenge or talk about. Like, definitely when I'm trying to have conversations about this with my family members, they don't even know because they haven't even started to notice or observe what was going on.
Funerals as well are a big thing. The women just automatically go to the kitchen and you know, and also it's something to do, so it's kind of like, you know, I would fall into that role because there's a reassurance in it that, like, this is what I'll do, I'll help with the tea.
Mm-hmm.
But there's never any men doing it, you know.
So the problem isn't then doing that, because I quite enjoy making your own tea.
Exactly.
My dad,
nothing
yeah.
wrong
for
with
example.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yes. But I also know that he would quite happily.
I
really struggle with tea. It's like in my family, because I've got like a love tea, and I'll always be like making tea for somebody, and like it seems to be the thing. Like, and so I also ran a tea shop. You know, a collective for a while, and then but I had massive problems with my partner's family and the tea environment, because I was told like that the tea was a rule in their house, that the women made the tea, and I was like,
oh, yeah,
like, finding it hard to breathe. And then I was also like struggling because I actually like making the tea.
Yeah.
And for a long time I did it because I was entering somebody else's house, and you know, that so I was like, that's fine. And then, you know, I've had to negotiate. It's such a small issue, but it's so massive, like the point where I say, I'm not doing it because you don't do it. And when do I stop being a guest? And and when do I have a say in the rules of the house?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The answer is never. Actually, but that's not an acceptable answer to me.
Yeah,
but it's just that that's taken like, yeah, that's 10 years of the negotiation, and like it's amazing.
It's
still an issue.
It definitely involved, about the other, just, you know, like, if I can just, you know, disturb a bit, you know, I have the other example, because I am divorced, and, you know, at some stage I had this mother-in-law, and it was very confusing, and always I was in stress, because she was just, you know, quite a traditional lady, and I always wasn't right, you know, I wasn't doing things right. And, you know, like, when we said about this hospitality, about the role of women, you know, like, I really like if I prepare food, and I really like to see people who are enjoying, you know. I like to make them some pleasure this way, but I hate to be instructed how to, you know, like develop my cooking skills. And, you know, like, you should do this way, you should do that way, you know, you shouldn't do that. You have to add more this, you know. Okay, come on, don't leave it there. It doesn't look nice. And all time, you know, I think we are also instructed by just, you know, like by older women.
Older women.
Yeah. And it's a kind of, you know, like, yeah, grooming, you know. That's right. Yeah. And we have also, you know, these examples of art, you know, like, you know, taking up this subject, you know. But it's also very present that, you know, like, we can't stand for each other, but, you know, like, we do it for, you know, for each other. I don't know why. I don't know what might happen with me when I turn, I don't know, 60. I hope I won't be like that, you know. But maybe I start to groom my daughter. I don't know.
Yeah, it's tough. Yeah,
but it's like that.
Somebody told me there's, like, 99 ways to hang out clothes on a clothesline. You know.
Yeah.
This is many ways of the right people kind of thing. Another way, oh, you have to hang it by the legs, you have to hang it by the window to go through them, or something, you know.
Yeah.
I'll tell that to my boys.
Okay, it is 12:45. Now, I have knowingly let this stretch, because I had what that means is what I had planned for an hour is now in 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this was a knowing negotiation. It's not like I have... I feel myself squeezed or anything. I could feel there was legs in this. But in this last 15 minutes before lunch, because I definitely want to preserve the full hour for lunch. Yeah, that's a hard and fast deadline, that one. So one, we end, and two, we begin again. So just in this last 15 minutes, what I was going to cover is this huge... these huge things, but it's okay. What I wanted to talk about, so I'm just going to kind of talk about what I wanted to talk about and talk in specific on one thing in particular. So there was three areas I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about why not activism. So this goes back to your first question of what is activism even? Why not activism but art? And this comes out from where I'm coming from, which is, which I... described for some of you in my book, This Is Not Art, but why I think art is more important than activism. So that was something I wanted to cover, and to own things as art. I wanted, and within that, I also wanted to praise exactly what you disparaged a second ago, which you can't help because it's in the art world, it's in the hierarchy of the art world, but in praise of the marginal... the interstices, which means the in-between, the interstices, the not mainstream, the ways of doing things differently. And I wanted to praise that, because there have been discourses in the art world at different times, though definitely not now, because we definitely live within the internalisation of neoliberal values. But there have been times when these exact spaces, the marginal, the alternative, the interstitial, the less than 1% of a going to put, you know, the knowingly going for 1% of the population and not 99%. That's now, even as I say it, I can hear everybody going, oh, that's elitist. No, it's just knowing that 1% of the population is where you're going to start. And so in praise of other strategies that aren't mainstream and aren't looking to the mainstream, that aren't looking to the popular, that aren't looking to the dominant culture, the dominant space. So that was another thing I wanted to, because that's very much what I talk about, I think. My interpretation of this not art is that in praise of that, and that that used to be normal in the art world, and we've lost it because we have now internalized neoliberal values. And the whole hierarchies around doing things in education. I just wanted to very, very quickly, everything, I worked at Tate Modern 2000 to 2004, a little bit to 2005, and I can tell you all the radical stuff that Tate Modern since owns, other than the very initial display, which was radical, so forget that. Everything since, say, 2001 to 2004 when I left, not when I left, that's all I know, that's what I mean, was done in the education spaces. And when it was successful, it was then owned by curating. So famously, Susan Lacey did a project in the Turbine Hall, and it was initiated by the education curators. It therefore had an education budget. So Susan Lacey is massive. I don't know if you have heard of her. If you haven't, that's cool. Massive American artist who had been working over here for a bit, over in Britain for a bit. Huge reputation. Grant Hester is a fan of her work. She was invited to work at Tate Modern in the Turbine Hall, which normally has commissions of £250,000. Okay, that's the normal commissioning amount for a Turbine Hall work. Not performance, but somebody whose work I am a fan of, whose name I can't remember, forget it. Some bloke who did a performance work in the Turbine Hall will still have that level of budget. She was offered £4,000.
Yeah.
£4,000. Okay. So just you know, if this is where,
because she was education.
Because she was went through education and not through curating. Different budgets. Education is marginal, and yet, as I say, the most interesting work that happened at Tate Modern, even you know, to this day, happened, most radical, most interesting, most innovative, happened in the marginal space of education. Later, when education, when curating saw how important it was then claimed as part of the curatorial program. So, in praise of, look to, you know, don't take on, I would say, a very important aspect of anti-neoliberalism or feminism is to not take on board the values of the mainstream, that it is only the stuff on the big stage, on the central stage, that counts. Because we didn't always see things that way. We have in the past understood that the important stuff happens in the side street, in the marginal, happens to small audiences. That this is as valuable as if there was 300 people here, or probably more valuable. So anyway, okay, the next part. There were two other main ideas I wanted to talk about. was this Levinasian ethics. This is the ethical engagement, ethical engagements with the other as other. This is what I got from this philosopher guy called Levinas, Emmanuel Levinas. When I say, I'm going to give you his name, but he is really hard to read, super hard. Even philosophers find him hard, and in fact, even hard to read philosophers find him hard to read. Okay, so he's a nightmare. I don't actually read him directly. I have had a go just to kind of get into the flow. It's probably more performative than it is like reading a philosophy text. It's like just let the words flow. But I read him through Simon Critchley, who is a political philosopher, and he kind of applies Levinas to politics. So I read it through him, and also through another blokey. These are all blokeys. Hutchins, whatever his first name is. Somebody Hutchins.
Sounds really familiar, Levinas. I mean, obviously, you know.
Yeah, he's around, and people like him, and the art world likes their continental philosophers, so he'll be a name that people use one small quote from and decontextualise him completely. But I'm my emphasis, because he writes a lot about a whole lot of things, and I don't agree with all of him, and I don't think that that's a problem. But I'm a fan of one aspect, and it informs my practice a lot now, which is this idea. Okay, this is his big idea. His big idea is that Western culture, our cultures, all of our us in this room's culture, is based on Greek culture, and that ancient Greek culture. And ancient Greek culture was based on a notion of philia, which is Greek for the same, a culture of the same. And that things that are other are horrific, or understood as mutations of, or...
Sounds very American.
Well, it's in the Western culture.
Yeah, okay.
What he means by that is the notion, for example, that a woman is a deformed man, okay, you know, because we're kind of like men, you know, but actually we have these horrific things like ovaries and breasts and, you know, and horror, a horror ambivalence at the bottom of the culture. He claims it comes from the Greeks. It's a very Greek way of understanding. He blames Greeks for everything.
Where is he from?
Oh, no, it's not that. He's from Western culture. It's just that he's a philosopher, okay, and philosophy is based on Plato as a starting point. There's no knowledge prior to Plato. If you meet a philosophers in that tradition. And so what he's doing is he's saying, nah, we don't base it there. Let's start again. That's what he's saying. So he's steeped in the West. It's just that he's coming from. He's bringing in another point of view and saying that the very foundations of how we of ontology, so philosophy of being, is based on this profound imbalance, this profound culture of philia and horror of the other. So he wants us to base our culture on ethical engagements with the other as other, so ethics rather than ontology or epistemology, which is the philosophy of being or the philosophy of knowing. He wants us to start our culture from the philosophy, from ethics, and that this ethics is an ethics based on understanding that each and every person is an unknowable entity in the world. So even before we get to cultural difference or cultural otherness or gender, even before that, two white men from the same, who went to the same school together, you know, or same cultural background, whatever, these people cannot fantasize that they know each other at all. There is a profound unknowableness in the other, and that all we have is the face. All we have is the face of the other, and then how we think we understand the face of the other. One of the things I like a lot about him as well is that he understands the notion of we as a violence. Because you are eradicating difference. By saying we, you are assuming yourself as the same and replicated across everybody else. So the various violences that he sees that are the product of European thinking... There are the product of European thinking has created certain violences, and one of them is the we violence. Anyway, I love him. I love these notions, and I've run with them in my own way. I definitely don't adhere to everything he says, but that's my starting point for my politics now. Is an attempt at navigating that value. Okay, so that. And finally, I'm doing quite well actually. Okay, and finally, feminism and feminisms, which you can see is going to kind of be teased out of this. Why I reject an idea, why I emphasise, let's put it that way, feminisms, is because again, it's about emphasising plurality at any one moment. And plurality because we're different people, but also because in 5 minutes we are possibly coming from a new position, a new person. So at all times it's isms and not ism, because feminism like any other contained concept can too easily create strictures and orthodoxies that don't allow for what's actually happening on the ground. I don't know if I can. I don't listen to myself. Feminism, like any other
containing concept.
Thank you. Containing concept can create strictures and orthodoxies that suddenly limit and miss what's actually going on. Because I have no doubt that even though we've been talking about our practices and framing what we've been doing for the last couple of days, whatever we do outside of this, at least for the last couple of days, we've been framing what we do in feminist terms, we've still got different ideas of what that means, and I don't want any one to predominate, because for me that's a violence. And where I'm coming from is this ethical engagement with the other thing. So I'm not looking for... So things like the conference you described for what happens and why I'm against a certain kind of discourse that happens of authenticity, that conference is a classic where, you know, I wish I was there to yell down the microphone or something, I don't know. But that conference where and you get this all the time in politics, it's not just a thing of the left, it's definitely a thing that I hear from Muslim activists that I know, of authenticity, and that the person who can claim the most authentic space, I am the most feminist, I am the most vegan, I am the most whatever, is the only one who ends up being allowed a voice. And there's ways of disavowing, like for me, this description, which I can go to this conference, but this description of the conference was...
It's really hard because it does replicate itself, because then, you know, you can't, there's no space for critique, I suppose, because as soon as you're saying this, then somehow, although you don't say it, you become more feminist at the conference, because the conference is, because if feminism is about like leaving those borders, which I think quite strongly that it is about breaking down those containers for things, that a lot of what they're trying to do is, if they're looking at like an exhibition that calls itself feminist, is to like dispute that as the definition already, so it becomes a little bit of a mirror hall of,
yes, everyone wants to.
But
for me, the starting point has to be that it is all of these things.
I still think that it depends on what your definition is. If your definition of feminism is that it does embrace different views, you don't need the S on the end.
True.
And we have it with communities in Northern Ireland as well. There is a sense of we've got to use communities instead of community, because we're talking about our different, you know, you're different, we're different, whatever. And really, it hasn't helped the sort of conversation, really. You know, it's really kept them in separate communities, rather than a community being everything in there, you know?
Yeah, no, you're right. Absolutely. This is the neologism thing. Like, you put the S on, or you invent a new word to try to say something new, and then it gets reduced anyway, because there's a politics behind why communities mean little bubbles that don't interact, rather than community.
I know why it was set up, but I
definitely agree with the principle of feminisms.
Yeah.
Although I sort of came in and
That's what I wanted to go to lunch with. Oh, and it's lunchtime.
Only because we're all here and I'm back.